It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, millions of Ukrainians are fleeing the country as refugees. We'll explore the U.S. role in helping deal with the crisis. First, recent survey data from the Public Religion Research Institute shows that the following of the conspiracy theory QAnon has increased since former President Donald Trump was in office. The far-right conspiracy gained popularity during Trump's presidency and the 2020 presidential campaign. Our next guest is behind that research and is here to help us understand the reach of QAnon and its impact on American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this? Do you know someone who believes in QAnon or promotes its theories in person or on social media? Do you think it's a threat or just a fringe thing that we don't need to pay too much attention to? Call in with your comments, your experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert P. Jones is the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, author of the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Before we get to your new research, can you give us QAnon 101? Where did it come from? What are the basic beliefs?
Yeah, well, it is a, you know, internet based and social media based conspiracy theory that has really also been importantly promoted on far right political news channels, including One American News, Newsmax, and Fox. So it has a kind of life on social media, and then it has a kind of little more mainstream view on cable news. So it's a challenge as a researcher to get your head around it. It has several sort of tendrils out there, but we spent some time, you know, doing some research, looking at message boards, and looking at trying to get our heads around the core beliefs, and basically ended up measuring three core beliefs. Here they come. So the first one, and these are all kind of agree disagree questions that we had in some national surveys in 2021. The first tenet is the government, media, and financial worlds in the U.S. are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. Now, that's a survey question I never thought I'd write as a researcher. The second one is kind of an apocalyptic aspect, that there's a storm coming soon that they will sweep away the elites in power and restore the rightful leaders. And the third one is a propensity for political violence, that because things have gotten so far off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. And so in the survey, we combined all three of those questions and classified people who believed all three of these tenets as QAnon believers.
There was a thought, I think, out there that after the Trump presidency ended, it was one of the things fueling the QAnon conspiracy theory. Therefore, people believing those things would decline. What did you find, though, in your surveys?
Yeah, well, I mean, any student of religion knows that kind of millennialist or apocalyptic movements always find ways to resurrect themselves, even after their predictions don't come true. But, you know, they were predicting Trump would win the election, that he would be installed no matter what was going on in the Electoral College, et cetera. And, you know, basically what we found is that belief in this ticked up slightly throughout 2021. So in March, it was 14% of the public that believed all three of those statements that I read earlier, and that it actually ticked up to 17% by the fall of 2021. Overall, it's basically 16. If you average all that out, it's 16% of the population of the country. But it's 1 in 4 Republicans and 1 in 4 white evangelical Protestants that believe, again, all three of these statements.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your guest answered part of my question, but basically I was wondering about the demographics of QAnon followers, ethnicity, age, economic income, education.
Tom, thanks for the call. Robert, you just mentioned Republicans more likely than others to follow this white evangelical Christians. What else do we know about core QAnon followers?
Right. So we did actually some fair amount of analysis on this. The data set that we have is quite large. It's about 20,000 Americans that we were conducting this research on. So we actually did some regression modeling to kind of predict what attributes were most likely to make one a QAnon believer. And by far, the biggest single predictor is actually consumption of far-right news. And that in the survey means either Newsmax, One America News, Fox News, but Newsmax and One America in particular, and other far right news makes you nearly five times as likely as those who consume mainstream news to be a QAnon believer. Conservative ideology, Republican identity, for example, are also high predictors. And then education level, having a high school degree or less, living in a more rural area versus a more urban or even suburban area. These are all kind of positively associated with and independently associated with being a QAnon believer.
Tom, thanks for that call. We're talking to Robert P. Jones, founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. They are out with a recent survey looking at belief in the QAnon conspiracy theory. Found it has not been declining, inching up, actually. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, your encounters with this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Austin in Lafarge. Austin, hi.
Hi there. My name is Austin. Thanks for having my call. Just curious from the gentleman, I've kept a pretty close ear to the QAnon conspiracy over the last year and a half or so. And from my understanding, the so-called Q has not posted anything in quite a long time. And it's been interesting in some of the circles that I watch on YouTube, seeing the sort of ideas pop up around why the Q hasn't posted, what that means, if the Q was nonsense. Wondering what your take on that is and how that plays into the life of the Q conspiracy.
Austin, thanks for the call. And Robert, Austin mentions a key part of the conspiracy theory. Allegedly, Q was someone who claimed to be someone with insider access at the highest levels of government, revealing these secrets often very cryptically online. And Q, at least the person or persons claiming to be Q, been quiet for a while.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. Like in building the movement, that is the seductive power, I think, of many conspiracy movements, is they claim to have a kind of insider knowledge that other people aren't privy to, like the real truth. Like we know the truth, other people don't. Other people have been, you know, fed this other lie. But there's an insider sense of being in the know, I think, is part of the power of that. And so it is, I think, quite remarkable. The caller is right that since the election, there's been less action, at least initiated by, you know, this mysterious anonymous Q person. And yet the movement itself is still quite animated. And, you know, we have to look no further than just last week, for example, that it's pretty clear to me as someone kind of studying this, that all of the emphasis and overemphasis we had on child pornography last week during Judge Jackson's hearings, for example, by some key folks in the GOP, were really about sending some signals to QAnon followers. This is a core tenet of QAnon. I think for many, many people watching were kind of really surprised or mystified at why all of this emphasis hammering on child pornography. And it's really because it was a signaling to this group of QAnon followers. Again, it's one in four Republicans who aren't just sympathetic, but are really believe all three of these basic tenets, including, and again, that first one, that the government, media, financial worlds are controlled by a group of Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. And so we hear echoes of that even as recently as last week at the highest levels of government.
We're talking with Robert Jones, CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute, looking at the reach and the popularity of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the fairly wide influence of QAnon, the conspiracy theory, the ideas it is spreading? Do you worry that it could lead to violence or cause interference with the U.S. political system? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Robert P. Jones, CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. Robert's talking to us about survey data that shows an increase in the number of followers of the QAnon conspiracy theory. You can join in with your questions, maybe your encounters with these ideas in person on social media. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Before we go back to our callers, Robert, I want to talk about why people might find this appealing, QAnon appealing, even after, you know, very specific predictions with dates and times of things happening, mass arrests, the return of the late Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from the grave. I'm not making these up. These are things that have been predicted with days, sometimes times. They haven't happened. What is it about this that makes people still embrace something like this?
Yeah, there I think we need to just take a big step back and ask, yeah, why now? Like, why are we seeing, you know, this movement now? And, you know, I think it's linked to the fact that we are really in the midst of a fairly recent and fairly dramatic shift in the demographics of the population. And that this has set off a really big sense of displacement. You see that in attitudes among QAnon supporters, for example. 7 in 10 QAnon believers believe that the American way of life needs to be protected from foreign influence, or that America is in danger of losing its culture and identity. All these things are really about demographic and religious change in the country. And I think the biggest one to understand, and its connection to kind of white Christian nationalism as well, is this sense that the America was meant to be a white Christian nation, and that we have in the last 15 years or so gone from being a country that was majority white and Christian. As recently as 2008, when Barack Obama was first running for president, the country was 54% white and Christian. That number today is 44%. So just from 2008 till today, we've kind of gone through this real sea change of being, you know, a country that's no longer majority white and Christian. And I think for a group that saw that as the core identity of the religion, and indeed even heard in Make America Great Again, that nostalgic looking back and restoring or reclaiming something that's been lost, that's really been the power of this. So I think it's just that we're at this real inflection point in American history in terms of our demographics and religious makeup that is making this, for folks who find that very alarming, a really seductive place to go.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Jeffrey in Mequon. Jeffrey, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. To the pollster, I heard you twice comment that the majority of the political demographic was Republican, 1 in 4, I think you said. Interesting. I didn't hear you mention anything about a Democratic demographic in this poll, or independent, or any other political bias. And I'm wondering, does that go to your bias, or what? Why don't you mention that?
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. Lower rates of Democrats and independents in your survey, Robert, support QAnon. What do you see there?
Yeah, no, happy to do that. I should say that all of this data is open and transparent on PRI's website at PRI.org, including the full questionnaire, the methodology of the poll, all of that. So I mentioned Republicans because they are overrepresented. The way to think of it, it's 1 in 4 Republicans identify as QAnon, or are identified as QAnon believers. That the comparison numbers among independents is 14%, and the number among Democrats is 9%. So Republicans are nearly three times as likely to be QAnon believers as Democrats. And when you look across the range of things, it is conservative ideology, it's Republican identity that are far more predictive of believing QAnon than Democratic or liberal identity.
Jeffrey, thanks for calling in with that question at 800-642-1234. Robert, you surveyed this in terms of these core beliefs of QAnon. Do we know if, people you identify as QAnon supporters because they support those beliefs necessarily would brand themselves or name themselves as specifically following QAnon?
That's a good question. You know, in this survey, we thought about this a lot and really decided that, you know, you can kind of go one of two ways in the survey because the way surveys work. If you choose the self-identifying way, you can't then follow up questions because the two contaminate one another. And we decided that the way to get at this with more integrity was to ask the substantive belief questions and not just identifying with the label here. So we don't actually have the self-identify with the label, but we went with the core beliefs. And that way we would also know exactly what we were measuring. Whereas if you just ask people to identify with a label, people might mean very, very different mm-hmm. things, right, with the label. So that's the reason why we went with this methodology.
Talking about the QAnon conspiracy theory still prevalent in the United States, Robert P. Jones is with us from the Public Religion Research Institute. Find information about the recent survey on the topic at prri.org. Robert, the material in this conspiracy theory is a very much, I guess, good versus evil. Sort of scenario, not, you know, our party believes this, your party believes that.
Yeah.
How important is that?
You know, I think that's at the core of it, really. And again, it's not dissimilar from other conspiracy theories. You know, the powerful cocktail, I think, that gives it its power is kind of a few things. One of them is that there is this battle between good and evil. It's a very binary set up, and then it makes it easy to map one's political opponents onto, you know, good or evil, right? And it's one or the other. The other one is a kind of apocalyptic time that we live in extraordinary times where there's going to be a revolution, like that second attribute that you know, there's a storm coming that's going to sweep away the current leaders and restore the rightful leaders, that there's a, you know, even a supernatural power coming. So it's mapped, again, not just to good and evil in a kind of human way, but good and evil in a kind of cosmic or divine way, so that one sees oneself inside that world as acting not just on behalf of good or evil in general, but on behalf of the divine or God.
Let's go back to our callers now. Barbara is with us in Boscobel. Barbara, hello.
Yes, hi. I find it extremely frightening that so many people believe these conspiracy theories and QAnon theories. I wonder if Robert has gained any insight as to why they believe this way and what can be done to bring them back into reality and believe truth instead of lies.
Interesting question, Robert.
Yeah, well, first thing to say is I would reinforce, you know, I've been doing kind of social science and public opinion polling for, you know, decades. And I would say, you know, I'm alarmed, you know, just from the standpoint of a healthy democracy, because, you know, these are not just far-flung beliefs in the abstract, but they're far-flung beliefs that have direct implications for a healthy democracy. And including one of the three tenets is that people might have to resort to political violence. So if you add a kind of battle of good and evil and this sense that you may have to take up arms to maim or even kill your fellow citizens, I mean, this is a very dangerous thing for a democracy. So, you know, I'm hopeful that, you know, I think there's no silver bullet here for, you know, kind of finding a quick solution here. But I do think part of it is, you know, having a different kind of story, right? And that's really what democracy's been, is offering a different kind of a way of dealing with political power. And it is the basic idea that, you know, yes, we have these political fights and debates and we have elections, and then, you know, we live with the consequences of those elections. And I'm hopeful that we can, you know, this is a fever that may break and that we'll get back there. But I do think the troubling thing here is that this is a set of things that is like, no, we can't let an election stand. And for example, QAnon believers, 7 in 10 QAnon believers say that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. Right. So they see it as illegitimate. And that sense of shared legitimacy, I think, is what we really are in danger of losing here. So I think anything we can all do to kind of shore up, you know, the legitimacy of our democratic institutions is, you know, the only way to hang on and to resist these things that are chipping away at these basic pillars of democracy.
Barbara, thanks for that call. Robert, in a past program, a caller brought up this idea. I've seen it suggested elsewhere. Continuity between key themes in the QAnon conspiracy theory and things like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories over the centuries. How much of this do you see mapping onto past destructive theories?
I think that's right. That, you know, again, where we have the evidence for that is in some of these other attitudes that kind of are very, very high among QAnon believers. So, for example, 7 in 10 QAnon believers believe that the values of Islam are at odds with American values and way of life. The gods, you know, granted America a special role in human history as a Christian country, and this, you know, sense of external, you know, threats. So I think those, all of those things are very, very strong, I think, within this QAnon phenomenon.
In just our last minute, Robert, what are you watching for now in this 2022 election season when it comes to the influence of this conspiracy theory?
Well, you know, paying attention to how much play I think what it really does matter. The other way of kind of moving away from this is it matters that 1 in 4 in one of our two major political parties have become susceptible to believing all three of these statements. And I think political leadership matters. So I think Democratic leaders for sure, Democratic Party leaders for sure, but I think it's the onus is even more on Republican Party leaders to really clearly denounce this and call their followers kind of back to, absolutely a fight of ideas, a fight of principles, but to call them back from this precipice of, indulging and believing in these conspiracy theories that are really linked to political violence.
Robert, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Robert P. Jones is the CEO and founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's author of the book White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. He joined us to share survey information about the lasting influence and prevalence of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Coming up after the news, we learn more about the Ukrainian refugee crisis and what role the United States is playing in the aid effort. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The percentage of white Wisconsin high school students enrolling directly into college is falling. As Rich Kramer reports, the decline is gradual but has big implications for institutions already facing significant and long-term enrollment challenges.
UW-Platteville's Richland campus is mostly quiet on this cold Wednesday in February. The only sounds come from the babbling Brush Creek and an occasional car pulling onto campus. Freshmen Jackson Kinney and Heath Zumach are studying alone in the Wallace Student Center cafeteria. Kinney says he's heard there are only 60 students at the campus, down from the fall enrollment count of 75.
Will this campus be here in 5 years? I've heard that question a lot, and we hope it is, but with enrollment this low, it makes you wonder how that is able to happen and how they're able to support themselves.
Kinney says he likes the small class sizes and is saving money by staying close to home. But enrollment at UW-Platteville Richland has fallen by nearly 87% from a peak of 567 students in 2014. Between 2010 and 2021, the UW's 13 two-year campuses lost about 7,400 students. UW System Chief Data Analyst Ben Passmore says that's a huge challenge, in part because two-year campuses are access points for students who may not go to college otherwise.
It seems pretty clear that the attractiveness of that kind of associate route, or certainly to follow that all the way through the associate's degree and transfer, declined over this last decade. I don't have a great theory as to why.
Passmore says one thing is clear. Fewer high school graduates in Wisconsin are going directly to college. His office is analyzing data from the State Department of Public Instruction, showing 59% of grads in 2015 enrolled as freshmen the same year. In 2019, that fell to 56%. The decline was higher among men than women. And at Wisconsin Technical Colleges, enrollment fell by more than 34% over the last decade. Administrators attribute that to a strong economy, low birth rates, and an aging population. Technical College System President Morna Foy says two-year college enrollment typically increases with unemployment, but that didn't happen despite job losses during the pandemic.
You know, typical decline around 2 to 3% annually dropped to 19% over the last 2 years.
She says new challenges for working parents, like the loss of childcare options and public school closures, likely meant a pause for tech college plans. As for the longer trend, Foy says higher education is changing and more people are seeking degrees or certifications after starting careers. And more high schools are offering associate degree programs. Some two-year UW system campuses are responding by offering four-year bachelor's degrees. That's what UW Green Bay's locations in Manitowoc, Marinette, and Sheboygan started doing in 2019. They're the only UW two-year campuses to see enrollment grow in the last 2 years. Chancellor Michael Alexander says the university is purposely ceding ground to area technical colleges.
We're still going to offer associate's degrees as part of what we do, but we're not going to compete for a student who's choosing between us and the technical college.
Sarah Burmish is in her third year of classes on UW Green Bay's Sheboygan campus. She's saving money on her nursing degree by going to school in her hometown. The five-year program is split between the Sheboygan campus, a nearby tech college, and a year of online classes at UW Green Bay.
This was a really safe option just to like come and sit, take some classes while I was trying to figure out my life.
The declining number of high school graduates going directly to college in Wisconsin means schools are going to have to figure out more ways to meet students like Burmish where they are. It's a critical challenge for institutions hoping to adapt and reverse long-term enrollment declines. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, millions of people have fled Ukraine to escape the Russian invasion. Most have crossed into Poland, and the United States announced it would accept up to 100,000 refugees and will continue to send aid to Eastern Europe. Over the weekend, President Biden met with refugees in Poland and called on countries around the world to step up and help meet that need.
Helping these refugees is not something Poland or any other nation should carry alone. All the world democracies have a responsibility to help, all of them. And the people of Ukraine can count on the United States to meet its responsibility.
The refugee crisis has raised questions about what the United States' responsibility is and how the country's handling these refugees compared to other humanitarian crises around the world. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think the United States should play in the Ukrainian refugee crisis? Were you glad to hear the U.S. is accepting up to 100,000 refugees from Ukraine? Should that number be higher, do you think? What questions do you have about the refugee resettlement process? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. She's chair there of the Public and Environmental Affairs Unit. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you, Rob.
We're seeing these numbers coming out of Ukraine. Can you talk about the scope of this refugee crisis, the number of people, the pace at which they've been displaced, and fit it into our perspective on other recent displacements around the world?
Absolutely. We are looking at about 3.8 million, quote, refugees, meaning they have fled across the borders of Ukraine. Internally, we have way more than that. We have around 6.5 million estimated to be internally displaced so that they are still within the borders of Ukraine, but they have been forcibly driven from their homes. So all in all, that's around 10 million people, but it grows every week. And most of those are women and children because, of course, men between the ages of 18 and 60 have been restricted from leaving.
How is the level of support for Ukrainian refugees compared with other big humanitarian crises in recent years?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's been some attention around that, especially the really disparate treatment of Ukrainian refugees compared with Syrian refugees. If listeners remember back in 2014, 2015, the Syrian refugee crisis was actually called the greatest refugee crisis in the world since World War II. And if we notice, the Ukrainian refugee situation is being called the greatest refugee crisis in Europe. since World War II. And there's something about that European aspect and the racial and cultural component of it that factors in as well, that has created a much more receptive and welcoming response to Ukrainians compared with Syrians and others from the Middle East and Central Asia and Africa in the last few years.
I want to give a listen to a recent interview we did. We know Poland is bearing the brunt of the refugee crisis. 2 weeks ago here on Central Time, we talked to UW-Platteville professor Andrei Ivanov, who joined the show from Krakow, Poland, where he was helping his Ukrainian parents with their escape from Ukraine.
The Polish people are very welcoming, and they are opening up their homes, and they're opening up their hearts, and they're helping, and they're feeding. And the students at the university in Krakow here are very active in volunteer work, in help, in finding clothing. A lot of stores, I see things, basic things, pharmacies are empty because they are trying to buy up medications for the refugees who couldn't take them with them. If you have only an hour to pack up your bags and leave your home, what are you going to take?
Can you talk about the humanitarian situation in Poland right now with so many Ukrainian refugees showing up across the border there?
Yes, definitely. Poland is hosting the most refugees at the moment. So over 2 million have fled directly to that neighbor. And this makes sense because Poland has already been a main destination for Ukrainians in recent years. Roughly 1 million Ukrainians were already working abroad in Poland. So there were a lot of connections established even before the war from Russia. And we also see a lot of cultural and historical connections between the country. You know, even the language, something like that matters in a moment like this when, there's a mutual intelligibility between Polish and Ukrainian that eases interactions. The European Union, of course, has also discussed a fair burden sharing. So it shouldn't fall alone to countries like Poland or those immediate neighbors, Romania, Moldova, Hungary. The European Union has really stepped up in the sense of offering this temporary protection directive. It's essentially going to enable Ukrainians to have a clear legal status across the European Union for residence, for access to education, healthcare, employment, accommodations. They're really framing that as sort of welcoming Ukrainians as part of a European way of life.
The U.S. Announced a temporary protected status for Ukrainians already in the U.S. and says we'll accept 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. What are your thoughts on the scope of that reaction?
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect, because if we would compare that to the Afghan refugee situation not too long ago, right, just this past fall here in the United States, we saw a lot of the similar momentum in the first couple of months for welcoming Afghans, especially those that had helped U.S. troops. And that number that the U.S. ended up evacuating for resettlement was a little over 70,000, around 76,000. So we can right away see that there is an increase in this number of 100,000 for the Ukrainian situation, and then a much more rapid response in terms of going ahead with, like you mentioned, the temporary protected status, which would enable at least 18 months to not worry about deportation for around 30,000 Ukrainians who are already here in the country. We also need to think about that number. That 100,000 is probably most will not be the formal refugee admissions program. A lot is probably going to be through that humanitarian parole or some visas, like there's this Lautenberg Amendment visa program that has for a long time protected religious minorities fleeing Ukraine. And so there could also be family reunification visas through that kind of program.
We're talking about the Ukrainian refugee crisis with Elise Cohen. She's an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. has a responsibility to help in the Ukrainian refugee crisis? If so, what do you think the U.S. role should be? Do you have questions about how this all works, the practical elements of getting help to refugees? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Green Bay political science professor Elise Cohen about how the U.S. and Europe are handling millions of refugees leaving Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the U.S. do, if anything, when it comes to refugee relief for Ukrainians fleeing the Russian invasion? 800-642-1234 is the number for your comments or questions. Mike joins us now in Madison. Mike, hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is the first time in my 50 years on this planet that there's a true moral righteousness to go in and help people. So far in my lifetime in Vietnam, Korea never begged us for help. Vietnam never begged us for help. Kuwait didn't beg us for help. Iraq, Afghanistan, no one has begged us for help. Ukraine has gone on international television begging for help in a war that we should be morally and ethically involved in. It's the first time in United States history we've been asked to help legitimately, and we are not. And I find it completely appalling.
Mike, thanks for the call. I think Mike's referring to the military side of things here, Elise, which we've also talked about on the show. More, is there a moral obligation, I think, for the United States to help with refugees in a situation like Ukraine?
Yeah, I think that the caller there, Mike, is really tapping into something that aligns with a lot of the rhetoric coming from the Biden administration about why the U.S. has an obligation to share some of the responsibility for Ukrainian refugees. You know, President Biden has framed this as a fight between a democracy and an oligarch. And these refugees from Ukraine have really taken on the symbolic value of representing support for democratic values and support for human rights. So I think that's part of the reason why you can see this framing around a moral obligation and a sense of solidarity like the caller is referencing, because there really is this belief that Ukrainians are like us and share our values, and therefore we have an extra responsibility in this case.
Mike, thanks for calling in. Kevin joins us now in Deerfield. Kevin, hi.
Thank you. I am interested in the Ukrainian refugee situation and the possibility of some of them coming to Wisconsin. But you touched on the Afghan refugees and just, you know, thinking about how to handle the Ukrainian situation. Could you update us on what the Afghan refugee status is? Are they all here and still need to be placed? Are there more coming, or what is the status of that? And if there's anything else in terms of, the overall situation, I'd be.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Elise, are you tracking what's happening with Afghan refugees and people, as you mentioned, on the humanitarian parole provision in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin raises a really great point there. So around 76,000 Afghans were admitted into the United States after that Taliban takeover from August, and roughly 67,000 of those have already been processed now at the U.S. military sites. So essentially, right before this war unfolded with Ukraine, the U.S. government was saying, look, we've finished the first phase of the resettlement for the Afghan evacuees, and a lot of them have been moved out of that temporary housing on the bases to actually get resettled into local communities. And I think we have around 800 or so have been resettled in Wisconsin, at least 160 just right down the way from where I am down in Milwaukee. So that has been in progress. However, there's this really big backlog, and there are still thousands of Afghans waiting at bases overseas, for example, in Qatar and the UAE, that have not yet had the processing occur. And then we haven't been able to evacuate still yet many thousands more who are at risk of abduction and killing and kidnapping of their family members still in Afghanistan, internally displaced. So there are concerns from some lawmakers that were really advocating for those Afghans from the start, that remains unfinished, and attention to it has kind of faded or waned into the background now that we have this new focus on a different refugee situation.
Kevin, thanks for that call. Elise, we had talked about changes in U.S. refugee policy in recent years, the numbers cut down, for example, during the Trump administration. Do we have the infrastructure, whether that's government agencies, relief groups here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, to be able to quickly and efficiently do something like bring 100,000 Ukrainian refugees and others into the country?
Yeah, Rob, that's the really tough question, because we did see with the Trump presidency that we went from around 100,000 or so with the refugee admission ceiling from the Obama administration all the way down each year to 15,000 by the end of that term in 2020. And as part of that process, there was a dismantling of the infrastructure for resettlement, and a lot of the resources really scaled back, even, you know, staffing really scaled back for refugee resettlement. And so part of the problem is, even aside from the Ukraine refugee situation, we saw the Biden administration has been making very slow progress on meeting its stated goal, even for this fiscal year. The stated fiscal year cap is 125,000 for refugees, but we're just around 7,000 people that have actually been able to be processed. So the backlog and the lack of resources and the dismantling by the previous administration does have a legacy effect.
Talking to Elise Cohen from UW-Green Bay about Ukrainian refugees, U.S. efforts at relief in Eastern Europe and here at home. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that I don't think we should be making these foolish excuses. This is the most powerful and the most wealthy country in the world. And I'd like to also remind people what it says on the Statue of Liberty. Give me my tired, give me your tired, your hungry, and your poor, your wretched refuse, yearning to be free. I lift my lamp beside the golden shore. This country can absorb anything. This country can do anything.
Linda, thanks for the call. Elise, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that Linda is really tapping into a lot of the Biden administration's emphasis that the U.S. should restore our global leadership with that kind of message that Linda is bringing from the Statue of Liberty, that we're really a safe haven and it's part of American identity. And you can see that distinction with Biden talking in terms of responsibility sharing, saying this Ukraine situation is not just a Europe or a NATO problem. It is a global responsibility, and the U.S. needs to play a leadership role. And that's really different, with that emphasis on multilateralism and working collectively, from the America First vision that we had seen when the resettlement program was taken down. So I think that kind of messaging and that framing really has an impact for people.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Elise, how about relief for people, Ukrainians in Poland and other neighboring countries who are hoping, I think, many of them to have a short stay and to find themselves back in Ukraine as soon as it is safe to do so? What are the key things for relief, keeping them sheltered and fed and things like that?
Yeah, that's another important angle of this. And the Biden administration did announce, as part of the 100,000 being possibly admitted last week, that there would also be this aid package of $1 billion in humanitarian assistance to Poland and to other Eastern European ally countries. And that is supposed to be targeted for humanitarian aid for food, shelter, clean water, and medical supplies. So we can see that there's a lot of outpouring of support in the humanitarian aid, not only from the civil society and the people themselves offering their homes and offering donations, but in the form of real government assistance that they will be investing for that.
And we got a question via our website from Mavis, who says, how could a person volunteer to take a Ukrainian family into their home? Elise, I don't know if we're at that stage yet, but in general, if people want to say, yeah, I want to open up my house to a refugee family or do what I can, what kind of things did you point them toward?
Well, there is a very interesting new pilot program that the Biden administration was trying out, mainly in response to facilitating Afghan refugee resettlement. And we'll have to watch and see now if it can be used for the Ukraine situation. But it's called Sponsor Circle Program. And I would encourage listeners, if they're interested, to just look up the Sponsor Circle Program. They're trying out this private sponsorship with small groups of Americans pooling together their funds to form a sponsor circle, commit to assisting refugees for the first 3 months they're here with things like registering children for school, locating housing and jobs, and undergoing background checks, taking online courses, you know, to ensure the sponsors are really well equipped to do that work. But anyone who wants to look can check out the Sponsor Circle program and see the website if it will move beyond Afghan refugees. Another thing would just be to work with the Wisconsin resettlement agencies that are really involved, like Lutheran Social Services or Jewish Social Services. So we have a number of groups even here in the state. And of course, a lot of civil society groups are taking donations at this time.
Elise, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you, Rob.
Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She was with us today looking at the treatment of Ukrainian refugees fleeing the Russian invasion and the U.S. role in providing relief. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can always email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, there's a big demand for mental health care in Wisconsin schools, but there's not always enough staff to meet those needs. We've had recent conversations on that topic. Check out a program at UW-La Crosse that's trying to meet that demand and provide these staff psychologists of the future for schools. That's tomorrow morning on the Ideas Network. Here's something that came up over the weekend. When you were a kid, did you ever get a special home remedy when you were sick that when you look back seems kind of weird? My examples for a stomach ache, my grandma would give me Coke syrup, like the stuff you'd mix with carbonated water to make Coca-Cola. For just about anything, I was from Michigan, the magical catch-all remedy was Werner's ginger ale, which is a big Michigan thing. Disclaimer, I'm not making any medical claims about either of those products. Also, one time my grandpa suggested giving me a shot of brandy for my sore throat. I was 9 at the time. My parents didn't run with that one. I asked around the Central Time team, Rachel Vasquez. She was a boring chicken super. Dean Canetter said Sprite and saltines. And Emily Burdett says her mom tried feeding her white rice in hot water, like a mushy, bland rice soup. Emily found it disgusting. If you've got something like that, let us know. Email centraltime@WPR.org. That's centraltime@WPR.org. Or tweet your weird childhood home remedy at @CentralTimeWPR. A spoonful of syrup. This is Central Time.